Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, on your electronic device via TuneIn, Progressive Voices, Tom Hartman app, and simulcast as television via Free Speech TV Network on Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems all over the country. Just wanted to share a couple of stories with you real quickly. The USA Today op-ed that Donald Trump wrote that was literally a lie in every sentence. USA Today has finally gotten around to publishing a fact check on it after they were shamed by the Washington Post, Glenn Kessler's piece yesterday, talking about that. This is pretty pathetic for Gannett. And in fact, we had a caller in the first hour of the program, as I recall, talking about how their local newspaper, which is also owned by Gannett — Gannett is the largest newspaper publisher in the United States by circulation, and USA Today is the largest newspaper in the United States by circulation — that their local paper, which is published by Gannett, had Trump's, quote, editorial in it today, and no rebuttal, you know, a little mealy-mouthed thing about this is just an opinion. But, you know, no, it's just a bunch of lies. And if you're a friggin' news organization, if you're going to call yourself a newspaper, for God's sake, publish the news. And I'm telling you, if the president of the United States sends a letter filled with lies to a newspaper, that is news. The story in USA Today should have been, "What? Look at this incredible letter that we got from Donald Trump. It's filled with lies. How can this guy even continue as president? What is this going to do to his presidency? Who in the White House allowed this to happen? Was Sarah Huckabee Sanders in on this? Did Donald Trump actually write this?" I mean, there's all kinds of stories there. But USA Today instead chose to be the sucker for Trump, the delivery vehicle for Trump. You know, I don't know what. But this really, really, really hurts USA Today. It really hurts journalistic integrity in the United States. It hurts the credibility of the news media. And, of course, the lies about Medicare and about the Democrats hurt all of us. So, anyhow, there's that. The president has said that selling apartments to Saudis, Trump Tower apartments, condos, and selling weapons to Saudis is more important than human rights. It's more important than an American resident, employee of the Washington Post, being literally tortured, murdered, and dismembered with a bone saw in the Saudi consulate in Ankara, Turkey. You know, that's not that important. What's really important is that they give the Trump Organization tens of millions of dollars, maybe hundreds of millions. They continue to lavish money on the Trump Organization by staying in Trump hotels all over the country. And they're buying, according to Donald Trump, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons from us, or hundreds of billions of dollars. The reality is that Donald Trump has not sold the Saudis a thing, from all the news reporting I've been reading. That when he was over there and he held up that big thing that said $12 billion deal, it was a letter of agreement. It was not a bill of sale. That deal is not yet done. But that was part of the Saudis sucking up to Donald Trump. It's true that during the Obama administration, there were a number of weapons sales made to Saudi Arabia that totaled something like $70 billion. But, you know, Donald Trump once again pulling a number out of his backside and using it to justify a regime that regularly tortures and kills people. And, I mean, literally regularly, like every Friday, and public beheadings. Oh, we're not going to push back on that. You know, it used to be, no, we're not going to push back on that. They give a lot of money to the Wahhabist preachers, and the Wahhabism is the source of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. But we're not really going to talk about that because we need their oil. Well, now we don't need their oil, although we're still buying their oil because we changed the law in the United States so the oil companies can actually export American oil. So you've got some oil companies exporting American oil, other oil companies buying the tar sands from Canada and refining them here in the United States and actually exporting the product of that. But we're still importing Saudi oil. And I think personally, I think it's time for us to reexamine our relationship with the kingdom if they don't start significantly changing their behavior. This is a really consequential issue. A Sandy Hook father, Lenny Posner, has finally sued a person in Delray Beach who works in the police department, Rhea Lynn Gerstenkorn, saying that on three occasions, Rhea Lynn illegally accessed his personal information through the Florida driver's license and driver and information database through her position at the police department. And this is a guy who for years has been battling this whole Alex Jones fueled thing that nobody was actually killed at Sandy Hook and his son is a crisis actor and all this kind of nonsense. It's just amazing. Mitt Romney has come out and said, this is absolutely brilliant, right? I mean, he's running for the United States Senate from Utah. It's a shoe-in, right? He's going to win. He's Mormon. He's Republican. It's Utah. And he's the former governor of Massachusetts, but, you know, and he ran for president. So anyhow, here is the quote for the day from Mitt Romney. It's frankly pathetic. I don't think it makes any sense to be talking about impeachment, not for a sitting president. Oh, wait a minute. You want to impeach a non-sitting president? It's nuts. The another story, this was actually in my Twitter feed this morning. I thought this is fantastic. This is fascinating. Specifically, they're talking about these long CVS receipts, but I've known about this for years. We've talked about this on this program a couple of times. I've done geeky science reports on it. The thermal paper that almost everybody is using now to print receipts and hand them to you at the store is thermal because of a chemical called bisphenol A, BPA. This is a chemical that when it's exposed to a little bit of heat, darkens. So they no longer have to use ink in these printers. They put this bisphenol A treated paper, and bisphenol A is a really cheap chemical. So they put this treated paper in there, and then they hit it with little hot dots, and boom, you've got a dot matrix printer that uses heat instead of ink, and it never needs to be refilled, right? No more replacing ribbons or cartridges or anything, which sounds great until you learn that bisphenol A is what's called a hormone interrupter. It messes with our hormones. When it gets into our environment, it causes animals, fish, and things like that to be born without genitals or have weird genitals or whatever. And we don't know what it does to humans, except that we do know it disrupts our endocrine system, our hormonal system. Whether it's doing it in a way that leads to disease is being debated, but hey, it is a disruptor. And not only do I not like getting these receipts, I always, when I'm in a store, I always say, just, throw away the receipt. I don't need it. But also, I think it's a tragedy and a disaster that all these people who are working these minimum wage jobs as clerks in these stores, every time they handle one of these receipts, this stuff does cross the skin barrier. They are getting BPA in their bloodstream. This is wrong. We had Congressman Ro Khanna on taking calls from our listeners, and a woman named Susie called in and said, I'm an elections official in Texas, and if you are told that you're not on the voting rolls, all you have to do is put all your information on the outside of a provisional ballot envelope, and you will be automatically re-registered in all 50 states. This information is completely wrong. Completely wrong. It's not even true in Texas, which she also asserted. She said, I've been working 20 years in the... No. And now I see from my Twitter feed, three or four different people tweeted to me. This one from J.C. Davis saying, Tom, provisional ballot Susie is likely a troll trying to mislead us. She called the Stephanie Miller show, too, apparently with the same sales pitch. So my guess is that provisional ballot Susie is a Republican or is working for the Republicans, because this is clearly part of the Republican strategy, is to suppress the Democratic vote. And she sounded so sweet and so convincing. And that's the most pernicious and evil kind of distortion of our vote. I'm just horrified that that kind of thing happened. I pushed back on it. Congressman Rokana pushed back on it. Susie was like insistent. No, no, you have to tell people all 50 states, just take your provisional ballot. Everything's going to be good. Just put your name on the back. You never have to worry about anything. Don't check. Right. It was all lies. BlindsGalore.com was the first place you could buy custom window treatments online. And because of that, they know what they're doing. They've been doing this for over 20 years and have covered over 2 million windows and know exactly how to get you the right blinds at the right price. They make it easy. They made it easy for Louise and me to go in and order. It was a breeze. It will be for you, too. Blinds Galore's products are hand-built from scratch, delivered right to your door, and created just for your windows. Their expert team is happy to help you every step of the way, either online or over the phone. Plus, they have the industry's best guarantee. If you don't like your custom blinds or shades for any reason, wrong color, you measured wrong, you don't like the style, you can exchange it for another covering for free. Blinds Galore will even set you up with 15 free samples and free shipping on top of the free expertise. It doesn't get any better than that. Blinds Galore makes it easy to get the custom blinds and shades you've always wanted in your home. Go check out BlindsGalore.com and let them know we sent you. That's BlindsGalore.com. On the line with us right now is Sarah Churchwell. Sarah is the professor of American Literature and Public Understanding of the Humanities at the University of London in the United Kingdom, author of the new book, Behold America, The Entangled History of America First and the American Dream. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for writing this brilliant book. By the way, I should add, you can be tweeted at Sarah Churchwell. And is there a website for the book?
There's not a separate website for the book, but it's published by Basic Books, and, okay. And it can be accessed there.
Cool. So tell us about the entangled history of America First and the American Dream. Give us the premise of the book.
Well, what I wanted to do was to actually look into the history of these phrases that we're so familiar with as phrases rather than as ideas, because if you think you already know what they mean, then you're not going to discover anything new. You're just going to demonstrate what you already assume their definitions are. But if you actually, you know, try to forget what you think you know and just look into how did people use these phrases in the past across the country when they started to emerge as national catchphrases, will any of our expectations be overturned? And in the case of both phrases, I think that they are, although in different ways. They emerged about 100 years ago, about the same time, and they both became part of the American political conversation in different ways. And each of them has something surprising to tell us, I think, and that I think is instructive and hopefully enlightening for the situation that we're in now. Very briefly, it's that the American dream, it emerged as a way to argue for basically the opposite of what we understand it to mean now. So certainly almost everybody, I think, I mean, I know this is a huge generalization, but I do think most people would agree that the American dream has to do with individual prosperity, with upward social mobility, with, you know, each generation doing better than the last, but particularly with individual aspiration, but an aspiration that's usually understood in really in terms of prosperity, and it's about, you know, opportunity, the Puritan work ethic, meritocracy, all of that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so people would say that if somebody goes from rags to riches, the kind of, you know, Horatio Alger classic version of it, that that's the apotheosis of the American dream, that's the realization of the promises to become, you know, really rich. But when it emerged 100 years ago, it actually emerged from the left to argue against free market capitalism, to argue that rampant unchecked capitalism and that monopoly capitalism in particular would destroy the American dream of equality, the American dream of justice, the American dream of democracy. And so they were arguing that the American dream was about a collective vision of a healthy, democratic, self-governing society, and that too much private wealth would throw off the balance, that you would only have opportunity for the few, not for the many, and the American dream was supposed to be for opportunity of the many. And I think it's a really important thing for us to know that now we think of the American dream as being, you know, this kind of shorthand for free market capitalism. But when it emerged, it was arguing specifically against that kind of radical free market approach and saying that, you know, arguing on behalf of regulation.
To put that in the context of story, would it be that today, increasingly, and I would say since the Reagan presidency, we've said that the American dream is Steve Jobs. It's somebody who, you know, invents something and becomes a billionaire, or Bill Gates, or, you know, fill in the blank. Whereas historically, and certainly this is my understanding of the American dream back when my dad used to talk about it, he worked in a tool and die shop his whole life, but he raised four kids. He could put kids through college. We grew up, six of us, in a three-bedroom, one-bathroom house, but it was, you know, it seemed cool to us. That was the American dream. Yeah. He took a two-week vacation every year. He bought a new car every 2 years, and he was a single breadwinner. I mean, that's the American dream, right, that you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's it, right, that the sense that the country was there to protect the rights of everyone and to aspire to equality of opportunity, but also that, you know, so certainly that notion that if you work hard, you could provide for your family, all of those ideas that are under threat. But, you know, they've always been threatened by inequality. And when too much wealth is in the hands of too few people, that opportunity constricts for everybody else. But now people, too many people, in my view, would say that the solution is the American dream of individual free market opportunity, but that's just exacerbating the problem.
Right.
Whereas 100 years ago, they were arguing, reminding us that the American dream was not about wealth. The American dream was about democracy, equality, and justice, and that those things would be threatened by too much, you know, individual accumulation of wealth and power. So that some of the earliest examples I found said that a multimillionaire would be the death of the American dream, because that was the worst possible thing for the country, for that much wealth to be in the hands of so few.
Wow. And then America First, the genesis of that phrase.
Yeah. So America First, unlike the American dream, it hasn't kind of flipped its meaning like that, but it is an older and darker phrase than I think most people realize. When Trump resuscitated it and it began to be, you know, used again and commented on, a lot of people noted rightly that it was associated with Charles Lindbergh and the America First movement of 1940 and 1941 to keep America out of the Second World War. But it actually is a good 20 to 30 years older than that, and it was incredibly ubiquitous in the political conversation in America from 1915 going forward. It was the campaign slogan of Wilson and his Republican opponent in 1916. Wilson used it to urge America to stay out of the First World War. But very quickly, it got taken up in the name of isolationism, protectionism. Harding ran on an America First platform in 1920 to keep America from signing the Treaty of Versailles and joining the League of Nations. He tried to pass a permanent protectionist tariff in the name of America First. And throughout the 1920s, again, in the name of America First, there were sweeping anti-immigration laws that were passed that were ruthlessly ethnic in their thinking, and indeed eugenicist, and that those were the immigration laws that established quotas of different ethnic communities. It was known as the National Origins Act. So only a certain number of people from a given ethnic origin were going to be allowed into the country, and that law held from 1924 to 1965. That was in the name of America First. So it was, as it is now, a way of talking about isolationism and protectionism, but at the same time, it became associated with the rising power of the Ku Klux Klan, which, of course, was very dominant in the 1920s, and they would carry America First banners. They took out advertisements saying that they were the America First Party, and they, you know, they actually tried to copyright the slogan at one point. I mean, that was how much they kind of associated themselves with it. The thing that, and I think, you know, people know that if you, you know, people on social media and in journalism have commented on the fact that the KKK is associated with America First. I think much less well known is that at the same time in the early 1920s, when Mussolini was taking power in Italy, of course, that was when the word fascism entered the English language, was when Mussolini was using it. And what I found was that in this conversation around the country that was happening in the early 1920s, people were trying to understand what this new organization, the KKK, was all about. And they were also trying to understand what Mussolini's fascism was all about, you know, maybe separately, right? But that was another thing to try to explain to your readers and for, you know, people to try to understand. And when people were trying to define these two things, they defined them in terms of each other. So what they said over and over again was, if you want to understand what the KKK stands for, it's basically what Mussolini is doing, but in America. Or if you want to know what Mussolini is doing, it's basically America first, but in Italy. It's Italy first. And they constantly treated them as synonymous and reciprocal. In other words, it was very, very clear to them that the KKK was a fascist organization and that America First was being used as a fascist slogan from as early as the 1920s. And it's just kind of everywhere in the political conversation in the 20s, and it increasingly became associated with white ethno-nationalist fascist movements, with an American fascism, a homegrown American fascism. And, you know, I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, I wasn't learning about American fascist movements. I wasn't learning about the history of American Nazi movements. I wasn't really learning about the true horrors of the Ku Klux Klan and what they perpetrated. You know, we learned about burning crosses. I didn't learn in school about spectacle lynching and about the fact that the KKK burned people alive up through at least 1934. And that was associated with ideas like America First.
Wow. Yeah, neither did I. What do we do with this knowledge? We're talking with Sarah Churchwell. Her new book is Behold America.
Well, I hope we use it to fight back. I hope we use it to recognize the danger that I really do think that we're facing. I think that we use it to fight back against arguments that what we're looking at isn't fascism just because it's a 2018 version of it, and because it's a very American version of it. And I think we use it particularly to push back against arguments by the alt-right that this isn't fascism, that it's not Nazism. I am of the school that says if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, then it is one. And, you know, I think we have to recognize the danger that we're in order to fight it.
So you're explicitly defining the Trump administration as fascists?
I think that they are promoting fascist policies, unquestionably. And where that takes us is going to be, you know, a question that we don't know the answer to and only history will show. But there are certainly some of the policies that they are supporting, particularly the white nationalist policies that they are supporting, they are fascist. And the authoritarian policies that they're trying to implement, some of those just are fascist policies. They are recognizably fascist. And the cult of personality that he's developing is recognizably fascist. The ways in which he wants the crowds to, you know, whipping up their emotions and always against demonizing groups of people and saying that they're the enemy of the people. Again, this is straight out of the fascist playbook, and we have to recognize it as such. Just because it sounds horrendous or rude people think it's exaggerated or alarmist, I can't see the downside to being alarmist. I would rather be alarmed and proven wrong than say there's nothing to worry about and then proven wrong the other way.
And wake up in a fascist country, yeah. Behold
exactly.
America is
exactly.
The book. Sarah Churchwell is the author. The subtitle, The Entangled History of America First and the American Dream. It's brilliant. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Great having you with us. I learned a lot. Today we're reading from Behold America by Sarah Churchwell, The Entangled History of America First and the American Dream. This is from the prologue. On Monday, 30 May 1927, a cool day with showers forecast, New Yorkers were gathering for the annual Memorial Day parades around the city. It was only 9 years since the end of the European War, into which America had been so reluctantly drawn, and Europe had suddenly become closer than ever before. Precisely 10 days earlier, Charles Lindbergh had completed the first solo flight across the Atlantic in the Spirit of St. Louis, and no one had yet stopped celebrating. Front pages around the country reported that Lucky Lindy had been mobbed in London, greeted by rapturous crowds of 150,000. Few Americans were talking about much else than the newest national hero, but in New York that day, different kinds of mobs were about to gather. Around 8 a.m., a group of Italian immigrants living in the Bronx set out for the elevated train on their way to Manhattan to join the parade. But they were not going to honor the American soldiers who had died in the service of their country. They were supporters of Mussolini, planning to join 400 American fascists who were marching in Manhattan's Memorial Day parade as part of the official fascist movement in the United States. They had been invited by the parade's organizers, to the outrage of many anti-fascists, including Italian nationalists and anarchists who threatened violence if the invitation wasn't rescinded. It wasn't. Like all his fellow fascists intending to march that day, Joseph Carisi was wearing the black shirt uniform, sporting leather boots, jodhpurs, a black cap, and carrying a steel-tipped riding crop. When he stopped to buy a newspaper, Carisi was jumped by two men, stabbed in the neck, and left to die on the sidewalk. Another fascist, Nicholas Amoroso, who was running either to catch up with his group or away from the killers, reports vary, was shot four times, once right through the heart. One of the two murdered men had served in the American Army during the Great War, the other with the Italian Army, papers reported. The parade they had meant to join took place without them, a fascist delegation of several hundred that was guarded by police to, quote, avert disorder. After the parade, the American blackshirts returned to their headquarters in the heart of Times Square. There, another of the fascists standing outside was set upon by three men. He defended himself with his riding crop as his fellow blackshirts charged out brandishing clubs and whips, chasing the assailant through the theater traffic in Times Square, who fled as the blackshirted mob tore through the traffic. 100 fascists, reported the New York Times, rushed the attackers. A melee ensued that was quickly dispersed by the police. There was also violence in Brooklyn, where a parade of fascisti marched from the Angelo Riza Fascista League at 274 Troutman Street in Bushwick. The LA Times reported several hundred men were parading, including 40 or 50 in the black shirt uniform. Fights broke out between supporters and protesters mingling on the sidewalks, and an anti-fascist was found lying on the ground, stabbed in the back. He survived and identified a fascist as his assailant. Accompanied by 30 police reserves to forestall violence, the marchers made their way through Brooklyn, stopping at the Wilson Avenue station, where the fascisti came to attention and gave the fascist salute. They ended at a Roman Catholic church, where the priest blessed them under large American and Italian flags, while the police remained on guard. The biggest outbreak of violence that Memorial Day, however, occurred in Queens, where it centered around a different right-wing group, not Italian-Americans, but the self-proclaimed 100% American kind. By 1927, the Ku Klux Klan had spread across the United States since its rebirth in Georgia 12 years earlier. The first Klan was formed in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, as former Confederate soldiers in Tennessee created a secret society to promote white supremacism, and terrorize the newly freed slaves in the South during the Reconstruction era. The name is generally believed to have originated from the Greek word for circle, kuklos, while Klan pays homage to the mystified Celtic heritage supposedly shared by white Southerners. Within a decade or two, the first Klan had been successfully suppressed by law enforcement and died out by the turn of the century. But in 1915, it was resuscitated in Georgia, and by the early 1920s, the second Klan had achieved a powerful political presence in the United States, not only in the South, but across the country. I would add this is because of 1915, the movie Birth of a Nation came out. The Klan had an active presence in New York City and Long Island by 1927 with favorite slogans, which they even attempted to copyright at various points. That year, the Klan was calling attention to the fact that it first announced the program of 100% Americanism and of America First. They were not, in fact, the first to adopt these mottos, as this book will show. In 1927, both phrases had been around for a decade or more. But as far as the Klan busily copywriting hate was concerned, America First belonged to them. And on Memorial Day in Queens, 1,000 or so of them had gathered to march, many in white robes and hoods. They were accompanied by 400 women from the so-called Klavana, the feminine branch of the Klan. Some of the reported 20,000 spectators in Queens that day objected to the Klan's presence, as others defended their right to march. Scuffles broke out, and it turned into a riot. Women fought women, and spectators fought the policemen and the Klansmen as their desire dictated, said a newspaper. Klan banners were shredded, and five of their number were arrested, said initial reports, while a few others were caught up in the confusion as well. The book, Behold America, Sarah Churchwell.
Riduzone. If you struggle to lose weight, listen carefully. Riduzone works. I've never before endorsed a weight loss product, but I've seen the result firsthand with my brilliant wife, Louise, who, like so many, has had her share of diet frustrations. Losing weight is hard, right? Louise heard about Riduzone. She did her homework, learned it's FDA accepted, and that it helps us lose weight in a revolutionary way. Riduzone comes out of university research that discovered a molecule that helps regulate appetite. When it's out of whack, we're always hungry and crave foods we shouldn't eat. And good luck losing weight when you're already starving on day one. Louise tried Riduzone. She looks amazing, and I've never seen her this excited about a weight loss product. Listen, when diet and exercise aren't enough and you want to lose the weight you've been struggling to lose, get non-prescription Riduzone. Go to tryriduzone.com and use the promo code TOM, T-H-O-M, to receive up to 65% off on your order and free shipping. That's tryriduzone.com, promo code TOM. Congressman Ro Khanna is with us. He is the vice chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, represents California. I believe it's the 17th district, right? Yeah, there we go. His website is Khanna, K-H-A-N-N-A dot house dot gov, and you can tweet him at Rep Ro, R-O, Khanna. Congressman, welcome back.
Great to be back on.
Congressman, I'd like to just kick it off with a question. I'll speak specifically of Stacey Abrams in Georgia because that story is in the news, but you and I both know this is happening in, I believe it's 27 states now are engaged in massive voter purges and have been since the early 2000s or late 90s. And in fact, the mother of all of these in terms of people knowing about it was Florida in 2000 when the BBC, Greg Palast was working for the BBC, and they did a report that played heavily all across England and Europe and was literally never played in the United States during that period of time, where the BBC reported that some 90,000 African Americans had been purged from the voting rolls just before the 2000 election to get by Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris in order to help Jeb Bush's brother, George, win that state. A story that if it happened in Panama or Nicaragua or Honduras, we'd be calling for the overthrow of the illegitimate government. But in any case, if Stacey Abrams loses Georgia by fewer than the 57,000 votes that Brian Kemp is refusing, people who are have registered to vote, but he's refusing to put them on the rolls, or for that matter, if she loses by less than the 570,000 that he's purged from the voting rolls in the last year, or the million that he's voted purged from the voting rolls in the last couple of years, what should she do? What should candidates, Democratic candidates, start doing if they, quote, lose an election in a state where it's really pretty clear that that election was rigged, and particularly if it was rigged in ways that would have been illegal before the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act?
Well, as we were talking right before the show, Tom, I think the first thing is she should refuse to concede. When Al Gore conceded to George Bush in 2000, that shaped the American public opinion. And it was Fox News, as you pointed out in our earlier conversation, who called that election prematurely for George Bush. So if this is an election that's close, under 50,000 votes, and Brian Kemp continues to refuse to recuse himself as Secretary of State, refusing to certify people who have registered perfectly legally, and that's the difference, then I don't think Stacey should concede. And it's somewhat personal. I knew Stacey back in law school, and she has been someone who has cared about civil rights and cared about economic justice since she was a law student, and she's a fighter, and I hope she won't just concede prematurely.
Yeah, amen. Well, we already have calls from all over the country, so let's just dig right into it. Noelle in Corpus Christi, Texas. You're on the air with Congressman Khanna.
Hi, Dr. Tom. Hi, Congressman. I'm calling because that editorial that Donald Trump put, the opinion, quote-unquote, that was in the USA Today paper was in our local newspaper. They put some comments in there saying this is only an opinion, yada, yada, yada. I called them, complained about it, because I think any opinion from the office of the president is different than any other opinion. I have not seen a rebuttal. I'm hoping there is one that the Democrats and the progressives are going to put out, and I'd like to get a copy and put it in our local paper at least. Is there any information about that?
Yeah, I'm guessing, by the way, Noelle, your local paper is probably owned by Gannett, the company that owns USA Today. They own smaller papers
yes,
all over the country.
They are a subsidiary of USA Today, yes.
Yeah, okay. Congressman?
Well, the best response to Donald Trump's op-ed is Donald Trump's own words. I mean, someone should simply print from his book, The America We Deserve, which he published in 2000, his defense of a single-payer system, his admission back then that Canada had a superior health care system, his argument in that book that while he's usually a free market person, he believes that single-payer health care is cheaper and has better benefits. So what USA Today really ought to do, and these papers ought to do, is take that excerpt from his book and print it, and print that side by side with the op-ed. Of course, Bernie Sanders has done a full response, but Trump is basically contradicting something he believed 15 years ago.
That's amazing, Congressman. I had no idea he'd written a book that said that.
He did. It's in America We Deserve, and he actually says, I think Canada has a better healthcare system than we do. I'm usually a free market person, but when it comes to healthcare, I think a single-payer system is better. And I really think the Democrats need to be pointing this out more, that this was Donald Trump's own view back in 2000.
That is incredible. Joe in Cupertino, California, you're on the air with Congressman Khanna.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning.
I'm really interested in trying to follow up. I made contact with your office, and I got a really nice letter in regards to your support of what's going on with the Kavanaugh thing. But, you know, yesterday I saw Senator Harris interviewing Christopher Wray, and I was dismayed. I think that Merrick Garland accusing himself from hearing this referral, and his admission that the scope and limitation set by the White House over the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings really concerns me. Now, Tom's talked about packing the court with more Supreme Court people, but I don't believe we should concede this nomination to or this appointment to the Supreme Court with what's sitting out in front of us. I believe Dr. Ford. And I'd like to know, as a Yale graduate, what you think about the fact that they were in the same class together, that being Christopher Wray and Kavanaugh, and how he can not recuse himself in the appearance, what appears to be a conflict of interest. And I just wonder what action you can take or who you can persuade to continue to run this to ground, because I think the Supreme Court deserves to be fully staffed with competent people, not just whoever's picked. And I'll wait for your answer. Thank you, sir.
Amen. Congressman, did you graduate from Yale Law School?
Yeah, I try not to mention that.
I'm impressed.
That's one of the best schools in the nation, you know.
Excuse me.
You know, it's anyone who went to Georgetown Prep or Yale is hiding in the closet.
Right,
of the
hanging their heads right now, right?
But I appreciate the caller's comments. And let me make two concrete points. First, Jerry Nadler, who hopefully will be chairing the Judiciary Committee, has said that we are going to continue to investigate the matter. The House Judiciary Committee will have tremendous power over this. And Nancy Pelosi has said that the FBI report ought to be declassified and ought to be made public, that we're going to subpoena that. We're going to subpoena the FBI. We're going to try to do our own investigation to get to the bottom of this. The second thing, in terms of the court expansion, I was just talking to Bruce Ackerman the other day, who teaches at Yale, and he pointed out that one of the things we ought to do is modernize the Supreme Court just from a perspective of what we need for the 21st century. The Supreme Court currently is only hearing 80 cases. That's down from 184 cases during the Reagan administration. The reason that they're not able to hear these cases is they have so many cert petitions, and nine justices simply isn't sufficient. The court started with six justices, and Lincoln and Jefferson added justices. So we ought to look at a reform that would be for expanding the court. Maybe you can have a supermajority required for confirmation to modernize the court in the 21st century. And that, I think, will avoid a constitutional crisis. But if we don't modernize the court and you have majoritarian policies struck down by a counter-majoritarian court, that's going to be far worse.
Yeah, and these are things that can be passed through Congress with a simple majority vote.
They are. You know, one other thing that, and this is Bruce Ackerman's idea, but he's spent his whole life studying the Constitution, you could actually term limit justices and then have them serve on a court of appeals, because the Constitution says they need to be in the judiciary for life, not that they need to be on the Supreme Court for life. So you could see a system of 10, 12 years on the Supreme Court, and then you go down to the Court of Appeals.
Oh, that's interesting, because at the founding of the Republic, they all rode the circuit. In fact, they did that until 1891. That's why they kept expanding, you know, the number of justices, because the number of circuits went all the way up to 10, which is why there were 10 justices during the Lincoln administration. And then, of course, they cut it down to six when Andrew Johnson came in, because the radical Republicans were seriously PO'd that Johnson was a Democrat, et cetera, et cetera. But all that drama. But wow, that's a brilliant idea.
It is. It's Bruce's idea. But, you know, his point is that one of the things he said, it'll stop people from gaming the system. Right now, they look for people in their 40s and 50s. you really want someone at the end of their career. And if you have someone say that you can serve 12 years, 15 years, 18 years, you probably have someone be appointed in their 60s, and then they go and serve on the circuit court. And so you get people also who aren't trying to game the system and have someone be there for 40, 50 years.
Yeah, yeah. And you do want people who are wise, and wisdom really is, the older I get, the more I realize, a function of experience on top of knowledge. Anyhow, the other story that most people don't know is how William Rehnquist got his job as Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. He started out in Republican politics in the late 50s and early 60s, just outside of Phoenix, Arizona. His gig, the thing that got him into and ultimately got him elected, was he would show up at the voting, at the polling places in Native American and Hispanic neighborhoods. And he was a big guy. He was like 6'2 with big, broad shoulders. And of course, back then he was in his 30s. He would stand outside those polling places and loud. And he was a lawyer, and he was very, he had a very loud voice, and he would challenge voters. He'd say, are you a citizen? Are you sure you're? And just scare the hell out of people. And they would, and pretty soon the polling places were just emptied. Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. You're on the air with Congressman Khanna.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to hit you with a real quick fun fact. The federal judge rules against extending voter registration down here in Florida. Judge Robert Hinkle said, nope, you're not going to. It hit where the hurricane hit, the panhandle.
All right.
He said, nope. Yeah, wasn't that nice?
Well, Tallahassee is a progressive city, isn't it? We can't let that happen. Yeah. We can't let people vote there. Forgive the interruption.
Right. College. And Gillum happens to be from Tallahassee. So, these folks know exactly what they're doing and who they're trying to disenfranchise.
Absolutely, the young voters. But my other question was, and I don't know if you know anything about this, because Congressman Pocan said that they're putting a committee together for the Teamsters pension. I'm one of those many 400,000 pensioners, and they're talking about now cutting Medicare. They're now talking about Social Security. I'm almost 60, Congressman. I can't make this money up. I was supposed to get $1,400 a month. And now I'm not even going to get Social Security on top of it. How long do they want me to work? I mean, I'm just asking, have you heard anything on our pension plan, the Teamster pension plan?
I appreciate you raising it. I have. And Mark Pocan and Rich O'Neill, who is going to be hopefully the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, and Tim Ryan, all have been working on this. There's a House bill to protect and shore up pension plans. It's just wrong for people like you to work their whole lives and then see their pension not be there for them. And so this is going to be a priority for House Democrats, and it's a priority, frankly, that progressives and more moderate Democrats share. It's a consensus view. So I'm quite optimistic once we get back to House that we should be able to get something done.
Ted in Gig Harbor, Washington. You're on the air with Congressman Khanna.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, if we knew about voter suppression and purging back in 2000, how come it wasn't emphasized or brought to light prior to the 2016 elections? And what can be done now? And can't we, sue the states for these kind of activities?
Well, I think, candidly, one, we were probably overconfident in our ability to win in 2016. I certainly didn't think Donald Trump would win, and I don't think many people in the party thought he would. And so we didn't do enough. And there was probably a complacency about how much people had already been enfranchised and how much we had already won these voting rights battles. And what we saw in 2016 was that's a very naive view. And the voting rights struggle is still very much alive. So I think the experience of 2016 has woken people up and made people far more vigilant.
Leonard in South Pasadena, California. You're on the air with Congressman Khanna.
You know that Citizens United, they say money is free speech. If that's true, then we have no free speech. We can't afford it.
Congressman?
I agree. That's one of the biggest challenges, that the loudest voices are those who have the most funding. Ref Feingold and I have proposed democracy dollars, which would make every voter a donor. And what we've said is the way to beat special interest money is give every voter $50 that they can spend a credit on a presidential, Senate, or House election that would dwarf all of the special interest money that is currently in play. But we definitely need some dramatic change in our campaign finance system to give ordinary voters and citizens a voice again in our democracy.
John in San Marcos, Texas. Boy, you got calls from all over Texas this morning. You're on the air with Congressman Connor.
Yes, Johnny Rosales in San Marcos, Texas. I just keep hearing people saying, well, we need to take it to court and what have you. Well, remember, people were screaming, I was one of them, during the Bush administration when he was packing the courts. Now we have a president who's put in over 80 life-appointed judges. How are we doing to get any real idea that the courts are working for us if they're packed?
Hmm. Well, the caller raises a great point, and the conservatives have had as a single-minded focus appointing conservative justices and judges to the point where McConnell hasn't moved some of the undersecretaries and assistant secretaries in these agencies because he has prioritized putting in federal judges and appellate judges. I think we need to learn from the conservatives and have that same kind of strategy and resolve that the Federalist Society has and that the Senate has, and make appointing progressive and liberal judges and justices a priority when we get the next president. And we really should be start planning that now and make that one of the highest priorities of trying to get that through the Senate.
Let's try Chad in Rockford, Illinois. You're on the air with Congressman Connor.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Congress. I'm a new listener, first-time caller. I just wanted to say that if Citizens Unite thinks that money is free speech, they are ready to give money to the corporations and the Democrats, but they won't raise the minimum wage to allow the working-class man to have free speech. And I don't understand when the two-thirds of the economy is consumer spending, and when Trump's complaining that interest rates are being raised by the Fed, why he wouldn't want everybody to have as much money as possible in their pockets. I wonder what the congressman thought of that, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Chad.
Well, I appreciate, Chad, your call. I certainly support a $15 minimum wage, and I do need to bring up Bernie Sanders and I 4 weeks ago did this bill, the Bezos Act, that said that companies that are billion-dollar companies like Amazon and aren't paying their workers $15 should be held responsible for the public benefits that their employees are using. And we were criticized by the entire Beltway, but we called on Bezos to raise the wage to $15. He did for 350,000 employees. Now we're going to try to get Walmart and McDonald's to do that. But in some of these places, we need to use public pressure, have workers tell their stories, and be willing to go for the jugular in saying this is outrageous that you have multi-billion-dollar companies that aren't raising wages.
Yeah, amen. Congressman Ro Khanna taking your calls for the hour. Khanna.house.gov is his website. You can tweet him at Rep. Ro Khanna. We'll be right back. He is the vice chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and represents the 17th District of California. We'll be right back with your calls for Congressman Khanna. Take one atom of nitrogen and bond it with one atom of oxygen, and boom, you just created nitric oxide, a miracle molecule your own body makes that fuels your cardiovascular health, keeping you vibrant. But as we all age, our bodies need help generating more natural nitric oxide. Superbeets by Human N has harnessed the power of nutrient-enriched beets and created a superfood that helps your body make more nitric oxide on its own. The core philosophy of Human N is to develop heart-healthy products for your body. One teaspoon of superbeets daily supports your cardiovascular health and blood pressure levels, giving you natural energy without the need of a quick caffeine kick or sugar high. We're talking real. We're talking healthy, natural energy. Call 800-568-9889 or go to tomsbeets.com and find out how you can get a free 30-day supply of superbeets and free shipping with your first purchase. Feel the 1 plus 1 equals boom effect of superbeets. Call 800-568-9889 or go to tomsbeats.com today. Congressman Ro Khanna taking your calls for the hour. And Maine in Chicago. Maine, you're on the air with Congressman Khanna.
Yeah, I would like to say that we're having a problem. I see like the Fourth Reich coming, but the American capitalist style. And what the thing that I think would help stop this if we federally protected the vote. I mean, made it where everybody votes and any restriction on the vote is subject to a prosecution by law, and get rid of the Electoral College so that one man, one woman, one vote counts. So we have a real true democracy here in our country. Right now, we don't have that with the Electoral College. And as much as we talk about voting, Until we get rid of that Electoral College, we don't have a true democracy here in America.
I would add, if it wasn't for the Electoral College, we would have a 7-2 progressive majority on the court right now.
Well, I agree with the caller. I agree with you, Tom, that the Electoral College is outdated and anti-democratic. I read somewhere that the Senate majority is now going to be representing about 18% of the population. So we do have these structures that are not reflective of the popular will. The only thing we can do in the onslaught of money in these anti-democratic structures is to mobilize and to get out and vote and to organize in a way that can overcome the concerted power on the other side. It's a fight for the soul of our democracy.
Lincoln in El Cerrito, California. You're on the air with Congressman Khanna.
Hi there. I'd like to talk about shifting the burden of taxation from corporate America to the wealthy. Money, income, profits are not actually wealth until they arrive at the individual. I think that the Democrats could steal a serious march on the Republicans by actually calling for a reduction of corporate income tax, not other taxes, but corporate income tax, and beginning a return to the progressive tax structure on the wealthy that we had before Nixon.
Congressman, I would like to add to what Lincoln said, and that is that sales pitch for no corporate taxes, which has been coming from the Libertarians and the Koch brothers for a long, long time, ignores the fact that corporations use our commons, which is what taxes pay for. Corporations use, you know, they've got an educated workforce by virtue of our public schools. They get to work via public roads. They use the same infrastructure, electricity, telephones, everything, all these rights of way that we collectively own. And that, in fact, you could make the argument, depending on the industry, and that might be a way to adjust taxes, corporate income taxes, or even just taxes in general. They actually probably, in many cases, particularly the polluting industries, have a much greater impact on the commons than individual voters do, or even individual billionaires do. So I think I can make an argument that we should raise corporate taxes back, like, you know, back to where they were back, you know, during the Eisenhower administration. 1/3 of the total income to the federal government was from corporate taxes. Now it's down to 11%. Your thoughts?
I agree with you, Tom, and there's no argument for the corporate tax cuts that the Republicans passed. They also are, by the way, the top corporations are consuming the most energy, contributing to climate change. Most of these corporations, the effective tax rate is 10%, in some cases 0%, where they're paying no corporate tax because of all of the deductions. And I have traveled around the country to places like Huntington, West Virginia, Paintsville, Kentucky, Jefferson, Iowa, places that voted for Donald Trump. I have never heard a local mayor or local community say to me, you know what, because of these corporate tax cuts, suddenly we're getting jobs in our communities. What they talk about is the need for high-speed internet, community college education, apprenticeship programs. The money would be far better spent on those programs rather than these massive handouts to corporations, which, by the way, aren't even located often in the United States in terms of the employee base. It's really a tax cut that's helping people, many outside the United States.
Alan, in Oakland, California, you're on with Congressman Khanna. Please make it
Thank
quick.
Thank you for taking my call, gentlemen. Sure. Our media constantly parrots the myth that our elections are free and fair. Most Americans are not well enough informed to realize the falsehood of that mantra. The Republicans only win by massive disenfranchisement, gerrymandering, but most pernicious of all, changing the vote counts electronically through totally unverifiable electronics in our voting systems with secret tabulation software. I suggest that every Democratic office holder immediately challenge the fact that we now have fake elections every time they take the floor in Congress or at any press interview or town hall. The demand must be for hand-counted paper ballots with full transparency now, with everyone being allowed to vote. The American people need to be educated that we have election theater, not elections, and the Democrats have been silent on this for the last 18 years since the theft of Florida.
Well, I agree with the caller that we need paper ballots or paper verification. I also think we need ballots to be posted on a website publicly so that you can trace to make sure that your ballot was actually received and counted, and there's a public accounting of that. This was necessary to make sure that people believe in our process and so that there's no tampering in any election. And the tampering is often most possible in local elections. I mean, obviously, it would take a huge conspiracy given the localized nature of our elections to rig voting machines in every county and every jurisdiction. That's not the case when you're talking about local elections where fraud and hacking is even easier.
Yeah. Thoughts on the next week, the upcoming week?
Well, we're in recess, so most of the focus has been, of course, on the elections and making sure that we are mobilizing our base and giving it everything we have to win back the House. I did have an Internet Bill of Rights that I put forward. I mean, after the news about the Facebook scandal and Equifax and now Google's breaches, we need some legislation that's going to inform Americans when their data has been compromised, that's going to require consent before your data is taken up. And I'm hopeful to push that when we get back in the lame duck session.
Mm, that's great. Congressman Khanna, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Thank you. Always great being on.
It is always a pleasure having you. Congressman Ro Khanna, his website, khanna.house.gov, K-H-A-N-N-A. You can tweet him at Rep. Ro Khanna. And he is the vice chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and represents the 17th District of California.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Let's check in with Bob Ney and talk media news. By the way, this report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Loving What You Do, Ellen Ratner's new book. Bob is the author of Sideswiped and the former congressman from Ohio. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. Always a pleasure.
So what's at the top of your list in the news of the day, Bob?
Well, having lived in Saudi Arabia, in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia myself, and of course, as you know, I lived in Iran also, 1983 in Saudi Arabia, I'm very familiar with the kingdom, saw how it operated when I was in Congress, and now we go to today, which is the first time that I can recall in our modern time that Saudi Arabia is actually sweating a bit. And, you know, Tom, I wanted to mention something that I don't know how much has been carried, but there's a very fascinating series of things that happened with Jamal Khashoggi. Now, he actually has
the man who
was
killed.
Yes, the man who was killed. I'm sorry. He has actually not left his home in Saudi Arabia years ago. He left it approximately about a year and a half ago, and he put himself in self-exile in Washington, D.C., and he thought he would be arrested if he returned to the United States. Now, Saudi targeted other people. It just hasn't made a lot of news. Raif Badawi got 1,000 lashes for insulting Islam. And Khashoggi himself was not exactly the I want a revolution guy. I wanted to mention that. Mm-hmm. He's not a guy that said we should overturn the royal family. And in fact, he was quoted, Tom, as saying that that type of regime change would be, quote, ridiculous.
Right.
I want to point out when his troubles started, because this is quite fascinating. Mr. Khashoggi, Jamal Khashoggi, was killed. His troubles began when he gave a speech to an American think tank after President Trump's victory. He argued that Saudi Arabia should be, quote, rightfully nervous about a Trump presidency at a time when the kingdom was cozying up to then, of course, President Trump, and we know the whole history of that. Now, many presidents have cozied up to Saudi Arabia. I'm not, you know, saying that. But I did want to point out his troubles seriously began with the kingdom, not over calling for a revolution, but his troubles began when he tried to say that, you know, that the two countries should watch the ties with the Trump White House. So I just want to make that crystal.
That's interesting.
Clear.
I wonder if that speech is what provoked Mohammed bin Salman to reach out to Trump and then do that whole song and dance to impress Trump and suck up to him.
Yes, and also the fact that the president's comments. I'm sure you went over that today on your show.
I haven't yet. No. What Trump said is that $110 billion worth of arms sales is more important than a human rights record. And by the way, it's not really $110 billion worth of arms sales. It was $12 billion that Trump, the deal that Trump thinks he inked. But actually, there still is no deal. It was just a memorandum of understanding. So there are no arms sales, at least from the Trump administration. A lot of this is, goes back to deals that Barack Obama cut. So Trump is lying through his teeth, as he always does. about this, but apparently, you know, the Saudis have handed tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars to Trump in laundering money or buying apartments and things, you know, from his companies. And they are currently staying in the Trump hotels, to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars a day in some cases, all over the country.
Well, you're correct. And also, here's what he said twice when he had a chance to at least backtrack a little bit on it, which he didn't. He has alluded to the fact that Khashoggi is not a U.S. citizen. Here's the quote. It's in Turkey, and it's not a citizen, as I understand it.
Right.
But a thing like that shouldn't happen, the president said. Again, this took place in Turkey, and to the best of our knowledge, Khashoggi is not a United States citizen. Is that right, question mark? So, you know, the point is Khashoggi is a resident. He lives in Virginia, and he works for the Washington Post.
Right.
Now, people are starting to put out a thing there, Tom, which is pretty disgusting, that, oh, the media never went after Saudi Arabia, only went when one of their own has gone after. They've always let them slide on human rights, which is not true. The media has more than exposed it, but the United States government lets Saudi Arabia slide. So I just wanted to mention a little bit of background. There's also a very interesting fact that because the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is the, quote, Mideast guy, you know, and obviously very close to the Saudis, as he was at one point in time with the Qataris through a loan, you know, his father attempted to get. A lot of wrath is going to go back to Kushner, too, on this, because there are businesses that are now are pulling out of this conference that Saudi Arabia was going to have, one after the other, including news media, including CNN and others, are pulling out of this big economic conference. Uber was the last to pull out. And Uber is fascinating on their withdrawal because Saudi Arabia funds a ton of you know, Uber monies into their system.
So, yeah, they were one of the early venture capitalist investors before Uber went public, right?
Right. And I think this is going to heat up. And I think it will become a bit, it could become, besides Medicare for All, you know, health care, Kavanaugh, I think this could become a factor in the midterms to see where, you know, some of the people, especially, of course, the Republicans trying to hang on, come down on this, because the president is setting the tone that it's not a citizen, you know, it's not... You know,
right, it kind of boils down to, do you stand for American values or do you stand for making a buck when those two things come into conflict?
Right, oil money.
Yeah.
You've got it.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, Talk Media News. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Jill in Great Falls, Montana. Hey, Jill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to point out that the woman that called in while Ro Khanna was on, encouraging people to vote provisional ballots, might be a troll, a Republican operative doing this intentionally, because I've heard her on other call-in programs.
Yeah.
And I think that it's just done intentionally to confuse people about voting.
Yeah, I'm with you. Jill, we have this this fabulous little phone system here that Shira is the lord and master of. It runs this thing. And it logs every single call. It keeps track of who called when and all that kind of stuff. That's why when you call in, if you've called before, Shira will simply say, hey, Jill, you know, instantly because of the caller ID. So, Shira, okay. if you could talk to Nate and get the exact timestamp for when Susie called in the last hour and then track down her phone number out of the database in the phone system, I would like to do a reverse lookup on that phone number and find out who the hell this is and why they're calling us with this kind of information. Jill, thank you very much for the call.
Oh, that's great, Tom. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah, and Shira just gave me a thumbs up. We're going to do that.
Yeah.
Remember, in November, vote. Double-check your voter registration. And we will continue these conversations. There's so much going on in the world right now. It's really important that we know what's going on. Please, one of the things that we have learned in the last couple of weeks is that people tend to believe their friends and family about the news. About 70% of people consider friends and family a more authoritative source of news. Only 40% consider the news to be an authoritative source of news. So if you're well informed and if you're listening to this show, I believe you are, please start telling people what you know and tell them about the news sources. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.